I might as well test one. I might as well ask my question before I forget it. Right at the end of our group, we finally got around to, I guess, what this opening session was about, some of the initial theory. And a question that I had was in terms of self-determination. And it came out basically more as a statement on my part of what I feel about self-determination, that sort of thing. If the native people in a land claim settlement are talking about self-determination in terms of a community, then that's all well and good, as far as I can see. I can't find a thing wrong with that in my head. It's very comfortable and everything. But if you're talking about a settlement that, in effect, creates another colony situation with the native people in control as opposed to the present situation, then I would suspect that what will happen will be there will be another land claim on behalf of the white people this time. And it probably will take a great deal of time, and there'll be a lot of haranguing too, and we could be involved in this process for several hundred years. So I wonder, David, do you see the question that I'm asking? How does the self-determination fit with your land claim settlement?
Well, I noticed that you drew two different type of pictures. One where the Indian people kind of have a direct municipal structure over which they have certain regulatory and control, and I'm not sure about the other structure that you drew. If that other structure is one where the Indian people will expand that type of municipal control which they presently have under the Indian Act, then I would agree to the extent that this evolution of government control on Indian lands will not produce the type of continuing a type of alienation of rights between people within the Canadian constitutional system. The position that we put forward is one where there is an evolutionary step between the existing rights that status Indians have now on their lands, and it's just an extension of that. And it won't be one where we establish our own little kingdom and we say, okay, Government of Canada, you've got approximately 15,000 white people on our land now, let's talk of land claims for them. It's not that type of process at all. And it's one, as I say, where we do, at least the status Indians, have specific rights on their reserve lands. And the federal government have stated and have demonstrated in past settlements, whether it be treaty, and especially in the James Bay settlement, where they get special hunting and fishing and trapping rights over and above the lands that they've got exclusively reserved for them in terms of actually residing on those lands. Does that answer your question?
It does answer the question. I think that what I'm talking about, and I suspect that what you're talking about too, is a land claim that in the end result will create a community of individuals, of people, where there is not one set of people distinguished by being discriminated against in any way, shape, or form, where indeed the community of whoever lives there is self-determining, can affect change, can bring their concerns to whoever is in charge of a certain area. You're looking towards a land claim settlement that in the end there will be a community of people all the rights of all of the people will play a part in the community. Is that a fair statement?
Well, only to the extent that, given the backdrop of the present Indian reserve system in Canada, where the Indian people have got a specific amount of land reserved for them, but it's primarily residential land, and they pass bylaws, which they are given to them under the Federal Indian Act, in which they can pass bylaws for, let's say it's in relation to dog control and the rest of it, they have specific legislative powers within that municipal structure which regulates all activities on their land. And the Indian Act allows them to determine what type of activities occur and who makes those activities occur. In other words, they determine whether or not a non-Indian person, in the status sense, can in fact live on their lands. And that is the present system that you have in Canada. We basically say that in order to adopt the whole concept of self-determination in the Yukon, that type of regulatory control by the Indian people, not only in respect of residential lands, but also possibly in respect to a wider spectrum than that, including hunting, fishing, and trapping type of lands, they would have to have a great deal of say about who uses the resources contained on those lands. And the government in the James Bay settlement followed that approach. And in northern Quebec, that type of approach has been accepted by the government of Canada.
Okay, what about immediate with that explanation, what I visualize is a community that is, if not exclusively, largely native. In a community where you have, say, a 50-50 split, how does that, in the community, where there are non-native people who, in terms of say, an education system and control that they would like to see, how do you work that within a community that is split between a native population and a non-native?
Well, that type of community exists in the Yukon today, and maybe let's use some specific examples. Let's take Haines Junction as one of those communities, and let's take Old Crow as the other one of those communities. You can see the type of evolution of self-determination occurring in Old Crow much more easily than you can see that type of self-determination evolving in a place like Haines Junction. It's not because the Indian people want to out and out discriminate against their non-Indian neighbors, but if you look at the evolution and of the historical development of a community like Haines Junction, where the Indian people were forcibly moved through the administration of the Department of Indian Affairs to Haines Junction, where they're forced to live in a community but yet not participate in the type of social development of that community, then there's definitely something wrong with that. And the Indian people are basically saying, you know, it's easy enough to say that we're 50-50 in Haines Junction, but in fact, we're not. In fact, the evolution of the territorial government structure is primarily applicable to those people who live up past the dump road, and the majority of the people who live on Block 30 on the dump road are, in fact, completely excluded from any type of social and political development in that community. And as a consequence, despite the fact that they do live side by side and that they do have a 50-50 composition, you'll note that the majority of the values, community values, are completely different. And the Indian community are now saying that we must have a settlement which is wide enough in which all of the community values can be recognized and we can work side by side. Presently, that is not happening under the present administration. Rather, there is dictation of community values, social, cultural, and otherwise, which is coming from a political structure which is not traditionally or presently a part of our structure. And all they're saying is that maybe there is a possibility that the type of structure which we evolve can assist in the type of integration which will eventually come about. But I can't see it happening because there is a 50-50 composition in the community where everybody gets together and pretend things are happy and say that this is our land claims collectively. In fact, it is not. In fact, it's based on different cultural and social precepts than that entire community, which that entire community encompasses. Does that kind of clarify?
Yeah. I have another question now. maybe just a... okay. I forgot what it was.
Perhaps that's a good time to move on to another questioner.
Our group has about 7 questions, so I guess I better start in on some of them. Dave, in your report, you said in 1975 the federal negotiations broke down because the federal government did not live up to certain parts of their agreement. Could we have more elaboration on this, on the parts of the agreement that they did not live up to?
One of the parts, I guess the crucial part of the agreement, was that before any papers or any discussions were to be made public by any parties to the negotiations, that was the federal party and the Indian party, that there would be consultation with the other party and agreement from the other party. But in fact, in the March 1975 proposal by Judd Buchanan, in fact, it was so public that Judd Buchanan, when he came north, he told us that that settlement proposal that he had, which he was going to present to us at 3 o'clock, was already tied into the satellite, taped in Toronto, to be broadcast nationally. And our position was, well, you haven't even showed us the document yet. We don't know what position you're going to present to the Canadian public. And whatever it is, it's contrary to the rules of allowing us to examine that, give a rebuttal or a response, but instead you're going directly to the Canadian public, which you feel is an acceptable type of an offer, which we haven't even consulted you with or even seen. And their statement was, well, we're confident in the offer. And the other one that they breached was, as I said, the degree of confidence that each party shows in the other in negotiations. And that degree of, or that principle of confidence basically says you don't release anything until the other party has seen it and without the other party's consent. And that was what they did in 1975. They just completely breached the very basic rules of negotiations, and that destroyed our confidence in the federal government's sincerity.
Lou, could we intersperse with somebody else now and have you come back in a minute?
We've heard tonight that land claims is developed from the concept of assimilation of the native people to the concept of self-determination, entrenchment of cultural rights, establishment of special status for the native people. The question I have is really 4 questions, and they can be answered in progression and by all or any of the panelists. Does this approach necessarily mean an evolution of a native separatist movement similar to what we're seeing in Quebec today? Should this separatist movement be avoided? How can the result be avoided if it should be?
Is that directed to anyone in particular or just the panel? Michael, do you want to make a comment on that? Let me think out loud. I think the identification of the native movement towards self-determination through settlement of claims with the Quebecois separatist movement is in fact quite inappropriate. And I say that because native people in their claims have quite specifically made it clear that what they seek is self-determination within the structure of Confederation, not outside that structure. And given the fact that Canada has always prized itself, in contradistinction to the United States, as having a plurality of cultural interests, and as having a cultural identity which is enriched and nourished by the diverse elements which have been forged out of Confederation, it seems that the whole concept of Canadian Confederation is premised upon the assertion of rights of cultural determination within Confederation, and to that extent the native claims really are towards perfection, not renunciation of Confederation. And I think that's a very important point to make, because in Canada we have gotten used to the fact that Confederation has taken place, that in 1867 the founding fathers, the English and the French, came together and Canada emerged. And of course what the Quebecois now threaten is a rendering asunder of that and a going of separate ways. Now, there has never been a perfection of Confederation so far as native people and the rest of Canada is concerned. There was never any negotiation in 1867 between native people and the rest of us. What there was imposed settlements through the treaties. Settlements which, as I described, extinguished rights and introduced a century of policies of assimilation. There was no mutual collaboration. There was no making of a social contract such as there was between the English and the French. And in fact, what the settlement of claims now we're now seeing taking place involve is really the perfection of Confederation. In the context of the Yukon and Northwest Territories, you're really talking about a new Confederation in the North. Because there's never, in fact, been that kind of fundamental agreement for the ordering of relationships between native people and the rest of Canada. And that, of course, is something which is different from the separatist movement. But, you know, the Quebecois, as I understand their position, is that they've had 100 years of this relationship, it hasn't worked for them, and therefore they want out of it. The native people have never been given the opportunity to forge their own relationship within Canada. And so I don't see the current claims negotiations leading to a separatist movement or, in fact, making clear, more clear-cut cultural distinctions in Canada. They've always been there. It's just the fact that we've tried to pretend for 100 years that native people are like the rest of us. Any other comments from the panel? Got another question, Lou? Oh, go ahead, Dave.
One of the questions that were brought up in our discussion group was concerning boundaries of other areas such as Alaska, BC, and the Northwest Territories. It was brought forth that and together today for our children tomorrow, the Indian people of the Yukon recognize the Inuit people of the Northwest Territories usage of the North Slope area of the Yukon, the traditional usage of it, and what they did, what the people wanted to know was what is the extent of the meetings between CYI and other groups, special interest groups or native groups in those areas? Have they held any meetings? And what in the process of negotiations, what kind of allowances are being made or thought of to be made to handle these boundary disputes? And I guess we could get two answers to that, one from maybe Steve and Dave.
The Council for Yukon Indians has met with basically the Canadian Indian organizations, the Union of BC Chiefs, the Métis Association of the Northwest Territories, and the Committee of Original Peoples Entitlement in the Northwest Territories, as well as the Alaska Federation of Natives. And I believe it was in 72 in which they formed a mutual association called Federations, or what was the name of that association? A Natives North of 60, Ron Vail, charter member, tells me. And but in their discussions, they did touch on the whole problem of border rights and control, and they did, at that time, as I recall, strike an initial agreement in respect of border rights, and that was basically that Yukon Indians can enjoy the type of Aboriginal hunting rights in BC, in Northwest Territories, but not really in Alaska, because we got a problem there with the American government, and they kind of check your cars when you drive past 1202. But in the Northwest Territories and in BC, they did agree that Indian people can go back and forth with no problem, and they can exercise their Aboriginal rights in the Yukon and in the Northwest Territories and in BC. Does that answer your question, Dave?
Dave, I don't know. I can't really add much to the point of the boundaries. I haven't been working with COPE at all. Do you have something you'd like to?
Well, just on the COPE aspect, besides that agreement with the CYI, there was also individual community agreement between Old Crow and Fort McPherson. So they have a mutual hunting ground, as it were.
Maybe I could just add something to the question. Dealing with separatism, it's, as Michael said, both the Inuit and the Dene are making the point that while they're asserting their right to self-determination, they're defining self-determination for them as a circumstance, a government circumstance in which they would control their own lives, whatever jurisdictional provisions that would mean. And they emphasize and re-emphasize the point that that would take place within the constitutional framework of Canada. But that's not implicit within the concept of self-determination. Self-determination has been used by third world countries as a basis of moving toward independence. It's most commonly understood as a political and legal rationale for independence. I'm sure the Parti Québécois would hold up the principle of self-determination as a basis for their move toward separatism. It's the concept, as I say, can be used to provide for independence. It's not being used that way in Canada. At least it hasn't yet by Native people. They feel that they can be self-determining within Canada. But I suppose the other side of that is that if... Maybe I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, to get back to the original question, Dave, I think you answered the question in as far as to give us information in terms of what were the meetings or what had happened in terms of mutual discussion on those boundaries. But I think what I was looking for from Steve, which I didn't really clarify, I guess, was basically the area of possible conflicts that may be involved in terms of both two different parties laying claim to one area, but those two claims being different in nature, say maybe for the process of the discussion, IT or COPE says, okay, we'll traditionally use the North Slope area, but we agree to have the Indian people of the Yukon have some sort of mineral rights to it so that they can go out and explore that, the North Slope, whatever they find there, they can exploit. You know, like, if, for instance, what was used as an example was the Oko porcupine caribou herd that migrates to the North Slope area. And what if there is a conflict of rights in one area? What kind of mechanisms in the negotiations between the different parties, what can be set up to prevent that? And if it does occur, how can they control it?
Yes, well, it's a difficult question, isn't it? It goes really to the perceptions of the claims. If one group, and this may be in part what you're getting at, if one group has in mind that essentially the settlement of the claim is one of the acquiring of ownership of the land, then the rights that attach to ownership will go with those, with the people making that claim. If another group has in mind that the claim isn't so much ownership of land, but looking toward legislative jurisdiction over that land, then there's an area of some difficulty there. It's conceivable that that one area, one group could own land, just as individuals own land, and another group could exercise legislative jurisdiction over it, to do with trapping, hunting, fishing, mineral development, whatever. It's conceivable.
So in other words, one group may have priority legislation over the rest, and all other groups' interest in that area will be subject to that first group's interest or ownership.
If I could just deal with that, not in terms of generalities, but in relation to the specifics of the porcupine caribou herd. One of the recommendations in Volume 1 of the Berger Report, which sought to deal with that, was the recommendation that there be established a wilderness park on the North Slope. And that recommendation was really evolved because it was seen that there might well be competing interests in the use of the North Slope, and that the North Slope should be viewed not simply as a life support system for the Old Crow people and for, in fact, people in the Northwest Territories who were dependent upon the porcupine caribou herd, but that it was a national heritage as well for a whole variety of reasons. And therefore, that particular area should be free from any kind of industrial development, whosoever would propose it, whether it would be native people or non-native people. And so I think, in a sense, that recommendation was meant to go beyond the particular claims of anybody, but was thought, in fact, to be consistent with the aspirations of native people who have the primary rights in that area, because all the native people who addressed the inquiry did so in terms of preserving the character of that area to ensure that the caribou would always be there.
Some of our questions are being answered by other groups, so we won't take up all of your time now. Another question we had was on the Nishka land claims. What was the basis of their land claims? Was it extinguishment of Aboriginal rights or the guarantee of the rights?
Is that the court case or the Nishka claim itself? The claim itself. Well, maybe someone from BC should handle it.
Well, the Nishka claim has in fact been negotiated in private, in contradistinction to the way the settlement process has proceeded in the Yukon in the last year or so. The Nishka claim has been negotiated behind closed doors. However, as things are wont to happen, some information has leaked out behind those closed doors, and certainly the claim of the Nishkas, as I understand it, is for entrenchment of their Aboriginal rights. Their historic territory is the Nass Valley, and they, in fact, have very clearly defined boundaries, recognized by other Indian nations within BC, and they have a defined territory. As it happens, the Nass Valley has not been subject to
to very much industrial development. There has been considerable logging activity in the area, but very little settlement. Very few towns have been established. And so, in many respects, the land is underdeveloped or undeveloped in terms of a resource base. And the claim of the Nishkas is that their Aboriginal rights to the Nass Valley be in fact entrenched, and that they be given responsibility, reflected in political institutions, to in fact to determine the future development of their historic homeland. Now, that's a fairly vague kind of statement, but that's pretty much as far as their claims have been made known to the public. But essentially, it is a break with the past in the sense that they seek entrenchment of their rights and not extinguishment in return for compensation. I mean, the claims of the Nishkas, in fact, are claims which have the longest historical background in Canada. When the Indian Reserve Commissioners came up to the Nass Valley in 1883, the Nishkas, in a remarkable exchange with the Commissioners, asked how it was that Indian Reserve Commissioners were coming up to the Nass Valley to establish reserves for the Nishka Indians. They asked, "We own all this land. I mean, we don't understand why you're coming up here offering us reserves. We don't need your reserves." And of course, the commissioners sought to explain the fact that since Confederation, the Queen owned all the land. And therefore, the Queen was prepared to come up to the Nass Valley and ensure that the Nishka Indians had, in fact, places they could call their own. And the Nishkas, you know, over 100 years ago, almost 100 years ago, asked how it was that through some acts in London and Ottawa could affect their rights. They asked whether or not there was any Nishka chief present at the negotiations, whether or not any letters were ever written to the Nishkas asking for their consent and participation. And in a sense, what the commissioners had to do was simply say, "Well, that's the law. That's the way it is." And the Nishka says, "Well, we don't really want to talk to you. We have nothing really to talk about, if that's your position." And that was really the start of the Nishka's assertion to their claim to the Nass Valley. They petitioned the king in the early part of this century. They sought to get the matter raised before the Privy Council. And in 1915, the federal government said that they were prepared to present a case to the Supreme Court of Canada for a decision on whether or not the Nishkas in fact did have Aboriginal rights to the Nass Valley on one condition, or a number of conditions. The main condition was that if the court held they did have their Aboriginal rights, they would agree in advance to surrender those rights in exchange for whatever reserves the government thought they could have. And the Nishkas simply said on those conditions they were not prepared to refer their case. And they didn't refer their case. In 1925, and when the parliamentary committee in that report I mentioned held that the claims of the Aboriginal people of British Columbia had not been made out as a token, as it were, for the fact that no treaties were negotiated in British Columbia, the legislature voted what's called the BC Special. It's $100,000 per annum to be given to Indians in British Columbia to make up for the fact they have no treaty money. The Nishkas to this day have refused to ever accept a penny of that. And in a sense, they've always maintained their position. In a sense, in 1973, when the Supreme Court held they did or had Aboriginal rights, and half the court held they still did have them, that was a vindication of 100 years of struggle. Again, it really is the best demonstration that Aboriginal rights are not an afterthought in Canadian history. In fact, they're fundamental to an understanding of what Canadian history is all about.
Thank you.
Okay, another question was Aboriginal rights and self-determination, are these essentially the two basic concepts of land claims, or are there others?
In discussing those two basic principles, Aboriginal rights, you have two definitions of that. You have the Supreme Court's definition, which is very restrictive, and Aboriginal rights, you have the Indian definition of Aboriginal rights, which is all-encompassing. And when you adopt that, or when you bring out the historic principle of self-determination, then you basically have the cornerstone of the settlement. And when you have that cornerstone, which is accepted by the federal government, then you have a claim which produces the necessary safeguards for the cultural and social advancement of the Yukon Indian people. And there are other principles which are involved in claims, but philosophically speaking, the adoption of basically the recognition and the entrenchment of Aboriginal rights, couple that with the principle of self-determination, and you do have the basis of a claim settlement, should it be philosophically as well as legislatively recognized by the Government of Canada. And presently, the federal government appears to favor that type of an approach to a land claim settlement. To a lesser extent in James Bay, what we hope to accomplish in the Yukon.
I guess the follow-up question to that is, now that the legal basis has been apparently agreed to internationally, has there been any other challenges to the Aboriginal rights concept?
I don't know if outside of Canada, if the concept of Aboriginal rights has been challenged in the courts. I think just to that question, a general comment, that as I said earlier, the notion of what rights accrue to Native people depends on your perception of their legal standings in the country. If you take the view that they're a colonized people, then the rights that accrue to them by virtue of citizenship don't do so, because the sovereignty by which those rights are determined is illegitimate. The exercise of sovereignty over a colonized people is illegitimate. The rights that accrue to them do so as an independent people, and the rights that accrue to any independent and self-determining people who have imposed upon them illegitimate forms of government. Those people are not dependent upon the legislation or the legal processes and legal concepts of the illegitimate government. Now, if you take the view that they are colonized people, then they have complete political rights, complete property rights to their traditional lands. If you take the view that they're not a colonized people, then they derive their rights from somewhere else. And that was talked about earlier. They derive their rights from being considered citizens of a country, and the rights that accrue by virtue of that fact. And they derive the rights from the treaties and from the legal concepts of the government that exercises sovereignty over them. And what the government of Canada has done is has said that they're not a colonized people, that our sovereignty over them is legitimate. And we've created this legal concept called Aboriginal rights that it doesn't define and protect the rights of Native people. To my mind, it defines and limits them. It takes away the rights they have as a colonized people. It's a rejection of colonialism. It's a make-do effort to conjure up a legal concept that will provide and limit the rights that the government of Canada thinks that Native people should have in lieu of self-determination. So that's an answer to the question.
Perhaps I could just add the fact in terms of international recognition that within the last 2 years there has been formed an organization called the World Council of Indigenous People. And the president of that is a past president of the National Indian Brotherhood here in Canada, George Manuel. And that organization consists of representatives and delegates from Aboriginal people throughout the world. Sami people from Greenland and Finland, Maoris from New Zealand, Aborigines from Australia, Indians from Central and South America, and also, of course, Indian and Inuit people from Canada. And in a sense, what they have done is asserted their own claims to self-determination and their distinct interests as original people at an international level. And they are an accredited organization before one of the UN governmental agencies. And in a sense, Native people themselves have asserted their own international rights through the formation of an international organization. And I think that's a very significant development, and in a sense asserts the common kinds of interests which Aboriginal people have throughout the world, irrespective of whether the governments within whose countries they live are communist, or whether they're capitalist, or whether they're socialist, or whether they're liberal, or whatever kind of labels we want to pin on them. There is the assertion that the history of treatment of Native people throughout the world has certain consistent patterns, and those patterns are ones in which Native people are not permitted the space, whether it's legal space or political space or social space, within which to sort of survive as distinct peoples within their own countries.
Any comment or further questions?
I come from a country which in fact takes a very active part in the Indigenous Peoples Conference, or in the Indigenous Peoples Organization, which is Paraguay, which has something like 110,000 Aboriginal people. Although if you counted Métis or culturally, and racially Indigenous people, there are of course many, many more. One thing that I've constantly feel that North American Indians and white people don't realize is to what extent Canada is in fact being observed and is a leader to these people. That land claims, the way in which land claims will be settled here will have a tremendous impact. And my own feeling is that there'll be decades and decades of similar types of claims now based on the precedents that are set in Canada going through Latin America. And it's very, very much, very, very closely observed. In fact, some of the organizations are setting themselves up on Canadian models, either National Indian Brotherhood models or on sort of on claims models.
Perhaps if I could just, with your permission, Bob, just make a very brief point. I think the last speaker's really touched on it. In the Yukon and in the Northwest Territories, above all else in Canada, there is the opportunity for a radical, in the sense of an opportunity for a distinct break with the past. Because whereas in the provinces you have provincial interests, both legislative and interests entrenched under the British North America Act, in the Yukon and the Northwest Territories, you in fact have the opportunity to negotiate a settlement which does break with the past and which really does offer a model not just to the rest of Canada, but in fact to other countries in the world as to the rightful role of Native people within a larger political entity.
I have a two-part question directed, Torres, for this. Directed first at Michael. Could you describe the argument that was put forward by the three Supreme Court judges that ruled against the Nishka case? And the second part of this question is, do those arguments also apply in the Yukon with similar facility?
Well, let me see if I can answer that without getting into unnecessary legal technicalities. The essential basis for the ruling of the three judges who ruled against the Nishka's claim that they still had Aboriginal rights was that in the period prior to the colony of British Columbia becoming the province of British Columbia, that is in the period 1858 to 1871, the colonial legislature had passed certain legislative acts which were inconsistent with the continuation of Aboriginal rights. Because the theory of Aboriginal rights as it's been developed in the courts is that Aboriginal rights are the rights of Indian or Native people, the original people, to use and occupy their traditional territory. And the legal theory, which as Steve described, is a theory which seeks to justify the assertion of sovereignty by the Euro-Canadian nations over North America. The incidents of that Aboriginal title are that it's a collective communal title, that Native people cannot sell their interests to anyone except the state, and that the interest is dependent upon the goodwill of the sovereign, and that the interest can be extinguished by the sovereign, and it can be extinguished by buying it, as in the treaties. It can be extinguished by conquering the Native people, as for example, which took place in parts of the United States in the 19th century, or it can be extinguished by an act of the sovereign which is inconsistent with the continuation of the Aboriginal interest. And the interpretation by the three judges of the Supreme Court was that the various pieces of legislation, the colonial land legislation in the period 1858 to 1871, demonstrated an intention by the colonial administration to extinguish those rights. And that was the basis for the argument. In terms of the application of that argument to the Yukon, I'm just wondering whether Dave Joe would be a better person to give an answer to that. I mean, I can, but perhaps Dave would be more appropriate.
My gut feeling is that they don't apply in the Yukon, Bob.
I think, if I can just add to Dave's gut feeling, I think because of that provision in the transfer of Rupert's Land in the Northwest Territories to Canada in 1870, and if I can sort of get into this argument without getting into Bill Smith's arguments of Old Crow, who incidentally was using the law library at UBC this last week, so I try not to have my answers unduly affected by his views, but the provision in that 1870 transfer that, in fact, the claims of people of the Northwest, the original people of the Northwest, be in fact settled in as equitable a way as the claims elsewhere in Canada, does have a constitutional dimension. That transfer document became part of the constitutional framework of Canada, and as Mr. Justice Morrow held in 1973 in the Caveat case in the Northwest Territories, it does impose a constitutional obligation. And because of that, I don't think that any legislation passed by the territorial government could in fact extinguish Aboriginal rights. I think it's beyond the competence of the territorial government to extinguish Aboriginal rights. And certainly there's been no legislation by the federal government which, in face of that 1870 provision, can be properly interpreted to extinguish rights. So I don't think the Nishka argument does in fact apply in the Yukon.
Extending that argument, then, it would mean that an alternative, a legitimate alternative, rests open to the Indian people in the Yukon to take their issue before a court. And the general, or maybe I should ask for a comment on that alternative as being a considered alternative, and how that affects or alters the character of negotiations.
We've quite frankly considered litigation, but there's a number of problems with that. And the first one is a political one. And it's basically this. It's catch-22 given by the federal government. We will negotiate with you on the basis that you don't take us to court. That's basically their catch. But that does not necessarily rule out the preparation of putting your legal case together in the event that negotiations break down. And I'm glad to say that there was some justification apparently for my gut feeling to your previous answer, Bob.
Following that answer of yours just now, the reason you might be not doing litigation, would it have anything to do with the fact that your claim involves both status and non-status people? And isn't this going to set a precedent Canada-wide?
Well, our decision presently not to get involved in the litigation stage does not necessarily flow from the fact that we are including non-status Indian people in our claim. And the reason for our non-litigation stance at this point in time is primarily we wish to exhaust the first alternative, and that is of negotiations. And should that prove fruitless, and the federal government know our position on that, and they have attempted to reinforce their position by tying us to a financial contract which basically says we'll give you X number of dollars on the basis that you pay it off down the road from your eventual claim. So they're optimistic that we will get a claim on the basis that you don't use these monies to hire guys like Ron Ville and Mike Jackson to take us to court on. And having learned contract law at UBC, we basically followed or carried out the spirit of the contract, and we haven't made any overt action to prepare that. But there is the political precedent which you mentioned, which involves all Indian people who have a 25% Yukon Indian ancestry. And this is a political consideration which is raised by the federal government time and time again. And we are optimistic, however, that that type of political consideration will not get in the way of passing the first negotiated settlement in Canada, which includes non-status Indians. And the federal government have accepted that. And whatever they do in the rest of Canada, we basically say that's their business.
One more now. We would like some elaboration on the transition period from when the Government of Canada did not recognize Aboriginal rights, I guess that was from 1927 after the Union Act, to when they did recognize the Aboriginal rights. Was it precipitated by the Nishka land claims or?
Yeah, I think it very much was the change of attitude was brought about directly by both the research which was done by the native organizations into their own claims and the historical basis of the claims, and the decision of the Supreme Court, in which, as I said, six judges legitimated in the context of the 1970s the concept of Aboriginal rights. As I explained, that concept has a long history. Anyone who had done any legal research in the area would have been able to discover, in fact, its longevity in terms of legal doctrine, but politically it has simply disappeared from view. I think I should say that the idea of the legal concept of Aboriginal rights was one which most lawyers prior to the Corder case laughed at openly. I mean, if you seriously raise the issue of Indian rights or native title amongst lawyers prior to the Corder case, most of them, in fact, would sort of shake their heads and wonder where you went to law school. In fact, in 1972 was the year I first taught native rights, and it was only the second course ever to be offered in a Canadian law school. And so, you know, the lack of knowledge of the legal basis of Aboriginal rights is one which was shared by most lawyers, and in fact probably still is shared by most lawyers. And that's, it's not as if lawyers have some immunity from the ignorance.
Are there any further questions?
It might be a little bit difficult to answer, but one member in our group brought up this question. Historically, we've been negotiating land claims from a British point of view. Does the process, as it now appears to have changed, take into consideration Indian people's philosophy?
We've, from 1973 to the present time, we have been negotiating with the federal government primarily to accept our philosophical point of view to the establishing and to the settlement of land claims in the Yukon. And we couldn't get past that first stage. You can't get to stage two unless you get past stage one. And we refused to move to stage two unless we settle stage one. And it appears presently that the federal government, through their adoption of a goals paper, which is document number two that was accepted by the cooperative planning process, has or is beginning to adopt that type of a native philosophy in respect to the entrenchment of Aboriginal rights as opposed to extinguishment. And it took us approximately 4 years of, at times, intensive negotiation.
Yeah, maybe I could just add something on that point, remotely connected. I'm freezing here, I have to talk. Freeze up. the Inuit Tepirisat, in moving its claim, has considered the concept of Aboriginal right, and is making the point to the federal government that as David made just a short while ago, the concept of Aboriginal rights that's established in the courts, legal writers in Canada define it as, is those property rights which accrue to people by virtue of having lived on the land since time immemorial. It's a definition of the rights of Native people by our legal system, and it's a very narrow one. It just provides for a property right that's personal and usufructuary, to use and occupy the land. It's not very generous. And as David was saying, there are other and broader definitions to the concept of Aboriginal rights, ones that include other than property rights. It's argued by the Inuit that the concept of Aboriginal rights provides for self-determination. It's no less reasonable to argue that you have a right to control your own political institutions and processes by virtue of the fact that you've been able to do that since time immemorial, and that right's never been legitimately taken away from you. It's as reasonable to argue that as it is that you have a right to your land because of that same process. So it's by entrenching the concept of Aboriginal rights, it's not taking you very far. And in the process, there's an effort to redefine what Aboriginal rights are.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if I'm not cutting anyone off, I thank you very much for your attendance this evening, and hopefully all of you will be here again, same time, same station next week.